You know, belief is a powerful tool. In fact, I think probably belief may be one of the most, or maybe the most powerful force within the human race. Although it's not physical, it has amazing power. As the old saying goes, faith can move mountains, and it is quite true. With enough faith, with enough belief, mountains can be moved. In fact, history is full of mountain-moving faith and mountain-moving belief. You know, medical mountains have been moved because someone had faith that a disease and believed a disease could be treated and cured. Technological mountains have been moved because someone believed that something that everyone had always thought could never be done could be done. Cultural mountains have been moved. Relational mountains have been moved because someone believed. You know, belief has an unbelievable amount of power. If you want to stop something from happening, just convince enough people that it can't be done and you'll never see it happen. On the other side, if you want to overcome an obstacle, just convince enough people, or maybe just the right person, that it can be done and you will see it done. Belief has healed the sick, it's overcome disease, it's brought peace where there was war, it's built schools and hospitals where there were none. Belief has brought the end to the slave trade, it's brought the end of racism, and it's brought justice to areas of the world where there was no justice. Belief has put people on the moon, and it's caused us to be able to fly around the world in airplanes. You know, belief has an amazing amount of power. And it's done a lot of good. But belief also has a dark side, doesn't it? Get a charismatic person, give him or her a platform and a microphone and a message in a very short time. You can have a genocide on your hands. You could have World War II, a crusade, or a jihad. All because of the power of faith, the power of belief. You know, belief is not only a religious term. Faith is not only in the area or the arena of religion. It's in everyday life, and we see it in everyday life. But obviously, faith and belief are very, very closely tied to religion and to religious faith. And because faith is so central to religious faith, often within faiths, there is disagreement as to how much faith one needs to be in the faith. This is true of Christianity. In fact, if you struggle to believe, if you've got a lot of doubt mixed with your belief, or a lot of, you know, unbelief with your belief and doubt and faith all mixed up, probably you often feel, and I would guess at times, you feel like you're just kind of a second-class Christian. Like you just don't have enough faith, you don't have enough belief, and this whole faith thing can just be a little bit controversial and quite confusing, and it can make us feel a little bit second-class. I remember about 10 years ago, I was in another town, not in Three Hills, and I was hanging out with some people and some family and so on, and we were playing basketball. And ever since I tree planted, often my back will just, my lower back, it gives me problems and reminds me I'm getting older and so on. But we were playing basketball and everything was fine, and I did this move thing. I think I was trying to keep up with my brother-in-law, who's a little younger than me and slower now. But anyways, but I try to keep up, and as I made a move, my lower back moved as well. And this excruciating pain went from my back down into my legs, and I just collapsed. I fell on the floor. I couldn't walk. I kind of half walked, half crawled to a chair. And of course, this is quite embarrassing. And so I'm kind of sitting on the chair, and I'm hoping no one noticed. Of course, everybody noticed. And whenever there's a problem, we have this thing as humans where we like to go to the person with the problem and tell them how we think it could be fixed, right? So everyone has their advice and their idea of how my back can be made better. Well, there was one particular guy there who was a person of faith, and he knew I was a person of faith. I was a youth pastor at the time. And so he came to me and said, "You know, Alvin, God wants your back to be healed. And God can heal your back. Do you believe God can heal you?" And I said, "Absolutely, God can heal me. I believe that 100%. And then he said, "Well, could I pray a prayer of healing over you?" I said, "Sure, you know, let's pray. I mean, that won't hurt. My back hurts, so pray. Let's do that." So he prayed a prayer of healing, and afterwards he said, "Alvin, you have been healed. Stand up." And to show my faith, my belief that I was healed, I stood up. And the moment I stood up, this excruciating pain in my lower back just hammered me down my legs, and I sat back down, and I, as kindly as I could, I said, "I don't think I'm healed. I just don't feel like that has happened right now." And it was true. Now, the one thing, you know, the implication that I was left with in this whole incident, of course, I kind of waited until everyone left or most people were gone, and then I held onto my wife and kind of half crawled because I just couldn't walk. But the implication I was left with from this incident is God wants to heal you, and God can heal you, and I'm not healed, so I'm the problem. God can heal you. And in fact, God wants to heal you, and he wants to heal you. And if you're not healed, then probably I'm left with this feeling like I must not have enough faith for God to heal me. It must be on me. It must be my problem. And I just felt like a little bit at that moment, a little bit like a second-class Christian. I've gotten over it since, but I still felt that. Now, maybe you've noticed in Mark, I don't know if you've been reading along in Mark or if you've read the Gospels before, but Jesus does this interesting thing when it comes to faith. He does this interesting thing where he says he heals someone or heals their daughter or son or someone, you know, in the crowd. And then he says this interesting thing. He says, your faith has healed you. And I think this is something that has kind of confused and bewildered Christians all the time, and it's confused me a little bit because, okay, what do you mean by that, Jesus? Your faith has healed you. So the healing wasn't really about Jesus. It was more about the person and the amount of faith they had. And so if you just have enough faith, then you're healed. And so is that what Jesus means? And how do we kind of reconcile this idea of faith? And I thought Jesus was the one who had the power to heal, but he kind of puts it on the person and says, your faith has healed you. What does he mean? And we have all sorts of questions like this. And today, we're going to look at a passage that I think kind of helps us understand this whole intersection of our faith and belief and our unbelief, our faith and our doubt. So if you have your Bibles, go to Mark chapter 9. We're starting verse 14. As you're finding that, if you remember from last week, Murray preached on Mark chapter 8, kind of the last part of Mark chapter 8. And it's this amazing moment, and it's this pivotal point in the Gospel of Mark. And this amazing moment where Jesus takes his 12 disciples, and they go to Caesarea Philippi, you know, north of Galilee and Capernaum. And on the way, or probably when they got there, he asks them a question. He says, who do people say I am? And they say, well, he's this and that. And then he says, but who do you say I am? And what makes it so amazing is Peter, who's always bold for good or bad, he's always the hero or the zero, he stands up and he says, listen, Jesus, I think that you're the Messiah of God, the Christ, the anointed one. And all the other 11 disciples are like, yes, we believe that too. You're the Messiah. And it's the very first time that someone among his followers has recognized him for who he is. You're the Messiah. And so it's this kind of amazing moment. Finally, they understand who Jesus is. And then Jesus does something almost, well, probably even more amazing. He, right after they finally confess, we know who you are, he says, now that you know who I am, here's what's going to happen. I'm going to go and I'm going to die, I'm going to suffer, and I'm going to rise back to life. I'm going to go and I'm going to die, I'm going to suffer, I'm going to rise back to life. And they're kind of bewildered, like, we finally get you're the Messiah, and now you're telling us, and he predicts his death and resurrection, and it's kind of this amazing, kind of bizarre, wonderful moment. Well, between that moment and the moment we're going to look at today, this healing, is another significant moment, and it's called the Transfiguration. And Jesus took three of the inner circle disciples, we know them as Peter, James, and John, and he takes Peter, James, and John up a mountain, and he's transfigured before them. Well, we don't really know a whole lot of what that means, other than Mark tells us that his clothes became blazing white, and Elijah and Moses showed up, which was pretty cool, because they'd been dead for like over 1,000 years, and they show up, and they were like some of the greatest prophets in Israel's history, and they show up, and so here's Peter, James, and John with Jesus, Elijah, and Moses, and then this voice, an audible voice from heaven, which is the Father, God, comes down and speaks upon Jesus these words, this is my son whom I love, listen to him. And so this amazing, amazing moment, and the disciples are like, wow, you know, we know you're the Messiah. Now we've seen, you know, this amazing moment. And surely from this moment, I don't know if Jesus had spiritual highs and lows, like we have spiritual highs and lows, and times we feel closer to God and further and so on. But I don't know if Jesus had those, but if he did, this would have been like a spiritual high, right? Finally, his 12 disciples that aren't, you know, always the brightest, finally they get it. I'm the Messiah. And then Jesus hears this voice, and the disciples hear this voice, the three, you know, this is my son whom I love, listen to him. And so I'm sure he's thinking, you know, from here on out, it's just going to be easy, right? I mean, the mission's set, the disciples are set, we're good to go. Well, not quite. I mean, in fact, it was quite the opposite. They come down the mountain, and here's what Mark says when they came down the mountain. When they came to the other disciples, they come down the mountain, that's Peter, James, and John, and Jesus. When they came to the other disciples, they saw a large crowd around them, and the teachers of the law arguing with them. You know, what are they arguing about? This is kind of like when if you've been to a school fight, you know, something breaks out in the backs of the school and all of a sudden there's this crowd that forms. And so there's this little argument and the crowd just comes from everywhere. Like, ooh, what's happening, right? Well, as soon as all the people saw Jesus, they were overwhelmed with wonder and ran to greet him. And we'll find out in a second why they are overwhelmed with wonder. What are you arguing with them about? He asked, that's Jesus asked. A man in the crowd answered, "Teacher, I brought you my son who is possessed by a spirit that has robbed him of speech. Whenever it seizes him, it throws him to the ground. He foams at the mouth, gnashes his teeth, and becomes rigid. I asked your disciples to drive out the spirit, but they could not." Now here's what we know about Jesus, as we've been reading Mark for a while. Jesus is the miracle worker, right? I mean, he's been doing miracles since chapter 1. He heals people. He teaches. He's turned a little bit of food into a lot of food. He drives out spirits. He's the one that does miracles. The question we may have is, what are the disciples doing trying to play Jesus? Like, who do they think they are that they can just step in and be like, well, Jesus isn't here, but we'll just play Jesus for Jesus because he's not here. What are they thinking? Well, this isn't the first time they've done this. In fact, they weren't doing it on their own. If you go back to chapter 6, three chapters earlier, Jesus had already started to hand off the ministry, his ministry of teaching and preaching and dealing with evil spirits. He started handing that over to the disciples, said, you guys go do it. You go preach. You teach. You go drive out. I give you power over the evil spirits. And so this isn't something this is their first time. In fact, they've already had a lot of success in this ministry. And yet all of a sudden now, as they've had all the success, this man comes with his son, and they're like, we'll just drive out another demon. You know, we've done this before. We would drive out another evil spirit. We've done this before. But they hit a roadblock, and they don't have the power. In fact, when it says they could not, literally, it means they did not have the power. They did not have the strength to drive out this spirit. Now, of course, the teachers of the law, we know they're not really fond of Jesus. And so they find out that the disciples have failed. And so this is their great opportunity to come and heckle the disciples a little bit. And they start arguing. We don't know what they're arguing about. Maybe they're arguing about, you know, the specific technique of dealing with evil spirits. Because there was a bit of a formula amongst the Pharisees of how to get rid of, you know, spirits and so on. And so maybe they were saying, oh, you got to use this technique. It's this way. And we don't know. They just start arguing and they have this big thing. And Jesus comes and the crowd's amazed, right? Filled with wonder. They're like, all right, finally, the guy showed up. You know, let's find out if he actually has power. Or maybe, you know, there's a power that's greater than Jesus. And so Jesus shows up. And Jesus, I think in exasperation, he says, you unbelieving generation. You unbelieving generation. How long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you? It's almost like Jesus is in disbelief at their unbelief. Like, didn't you get it yet? And the question is, when he refers to generation, who's he referring to? Is he talking to the Father? Is he talking to the crowd, the Pharisees? Is he talking to the disciples? Who's he saying, unbelieving generation? I kind of wonder if, you know, probably he's not talking to the Father, because the Father has enough belief or faith to actually come to the disciples to have his son healed. So he's shown a certain amount of faith. And so I don't think he's necessarily saying, you unbelieving generation, to them. I wonder if he's saying this to his disciples. You know, you guys have been with me. You've been with me. You finally confessed that I'm the Messiah. I thought you got this already. And now you've missed it. I thought this was going to be easy sailing. But you unbelieving generation, how long am I going to have to stay with you guys until you finally get this? I think he's just kind of exasperated, like, disciples, don't you get it yet? And he chastises them. And they didn't get it. So he says, okay, just bring the boy to me. Let's do this all over again. So they brought him. When the spirit saw Jesus, it immediately threw the boy into a convulsion. He fell to the ground and rolled around, foaming at the mouth. Jesus sees the extent of this boy's suffering. Jesus asked the boy's father, how long has he been like this? From childhood, he answered. It's often thrown him into the fire or water to kill him. But if you can do anything, would you take pity? Would you take pity on us? Would you help us? You know, we find that we see the internal struggle of this man, the pain of this man who, for the boy's entire life, since childhood, this father has had to sleep with one eye open because he knows his son has a spirit in him that's desiring to kill him. And he can't go on vacation and build a fire and just enjoy it because probably the spirit's going to try and throw the son into, you know, he's living with this anxiety that at any moment his son could be killed. He's got to watch him day and night, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And he says, would you just have compassion? Could you see how painful this has been for me to watch my son? How hard this has been on me. And you can imagine he heard Jesus was in the area. And he heard that Jesus had power over spirits. And so in his excitement, he came to Jesus, only finding Jesus and Peter, James, and John were up a mountain somewhere. And he couldn't have his son healed, but maybe the disciples could heal his son. And so he brings his son to the disciples who try and try and try and fail. And so he reveals his doubt. He says, you know, if you can, I'm not banking on it. Your disciples couldn't, but if you can, I know you have compassion for people, but this is a big, big problem. If you can. You know, in some ways, his faith had been shattered by the failure of the disciples. And it's shown as he comes to Jesus, if you can. You know, I imagine some of you, your faith has been shattered or broken the same way. You came to a church, you came to a pastor, you came to a Christian, you came to a follower of Jesus, someone who represented Jesus or God, and you had a problem that you hoped beyond hoped that they would be able to do something about. And yet the church proved powerless, and that person and that pastor proved powerless, and you're not sure. Is it worth following the God they follow? Is it worth following the Jesus they claim has so much power? And like this father whose faith was shattered, and finally when he met Jesus, he said, I don't know, but if you can. Maybe that's where you are. Your faith has been left battered and tattered by others. And he shows his hand. He's got a lot of doubt mixed with some faith. And Jesus, he replies, I think almost sighing, he says, if you can, listen, everything is possible for one who believes. Everything. Now, Jesus, do you mean like mostly everything? I think he means like everything. Like there's nothing that can't be done. Everything is possible for him or for the one who believes. You know, Matthew's gospel, because Matthew records this story as well, and in his gospel, he makes this little statement. Jesus responds this way. He says, Jesus has this little thing he says where he says, you know, if you have faith as small as a mustard seed, you can say to this mountain and that mountain, move, and it will be moved. And here Jesus says, you know, Mark records it this way. He says, you know, everything is possible for one who believes. Everything is possible. So does that mean that, you know, we just need some more belief? You know, if you just believe, everything will happen the way you want. If you just have faith, I mean, you don't even need a lot of faith. Matthew says, you just need faith as small as a mustard seed. So do we just need more faith to see more miracles? Do we need more belief to see more things happen that could never happen? Is it just faith in faith? What do we believe in? Or does it matter? Because here it just says believe. Does it matter what you believe in as long as you believe? And we saw earlier, many, many miracles and mountains have been moved just because of belief. just because of faith. What is Jesus saying? Well, notice he does not say that everything is beneficial, and he does not say everything is possible for the one who believes. He just says, probable rather. He says it's possible, not necessarily probable. It could happen. So Jesus is asking, do you believe? Everything's possible. Do you believe? And the man's reply is quite honest, I think. He kind of says, yes. No, I don't know, maybe, sure, yes. Here's how he says it. Immediately, the boy's father explained, I do believe. I do, I'm all in. And he says, well, not really. Help me overcome my unbelief. It's almost like he says, listen, I've got this problem, Jesus. I've got a lot of belief, or maybe I don't even know if I have a lot of belief, but I do believe. But I still got this unbelief thing happening. So could you help me? Could you help me with my unbelief? Could you help me take action, not on the unbelief, but take action on the belief? And what we see instantly is that doubt and faith can coexist. Belief and unbelief can actually coexist. Doubt and faith and belief and unbelief are not like light and dark. They're not like wet and dry. It's not that you have to completely remove one to finally have the other. You don't completely have to get rid of all your doubts so you can finally be a person of faith. You don't completely have to get rid of all your unbelief so you can finally be a person who believes. That in fact, you can come to God with an aspect of unbelief and belief. Praying that same prayer the Father prayed to Jesus. Would you help me with my unbelief? Well, in Jesus saw that the crowd was running to the scene, he rebuked the impure spirit. You deaf and mute spirit, he said, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again. The spirit shrieked, convulsed him violently, and came out. The boy looked so much like a corpse that many said, he's dead. But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him to his feet, and he stood up. Jesus healed him. Amazing. He does a miracle. He moved a mountain in the Father's life. But you know, there's still a question, a really important question that needs to be asked. And this was just driving the disciples insane. This was the question they were saying, okay, wait a second, Jesus. And when they got alone with him, they asked him, and after Jesus, Mark tells us, had gone indoors, his disciples asked him privately, okay, here's the question. Why could we not drive him out? Why couldn't we? Why could you, but why couldn't we? We've driven out demons. We've driven out evil spirits before. We've had power before. What happened? Why the roadblock this time? Why couldn't we? And Jesus has a very interesting response. I think it's interesting and confusing and a little bewildering. He says this. He replied, this kind can only come out by prayer. This kind can come out only by prayer. Which is an interesting and a little bit confusing response because, well, earlier to the boy's father, Jesus had said, what? You unbelieving generation. He didn't say anything about prayer. He said, the problem is your belief, you unbelieving generation. Now he says prayer. The other thing that's kind of bewildering is at no point does Mark tell us that Jesus stopped to fold his hands, bow his head and pray. Jesus does not pray in the healing. So the very thing Jesus says you have to have for this kind of healing, Jesus doesn't do. Just kind of confusing. What are you trying to say, Jesus? What are you trying to say? Well, I think to make sense of this, we have to maybe understand how Jesus viewed prayer. You know, often we think of prayer as communication to God, right? We fold our hands, we close our eyes, and we tell God all the things that he should do for us. Or all the things we'd like him to do. It's kind of this one-way conversation where we kind of make our wish list to God. For Jesus, prayer was very different. It wasn't a one-way conversation, it was communication. In fact, I think a better word than communication, actually, the way Jesus understood prayer, was communion. It was communion with God. It did not need a folding of hands and a closing of eyes. Prayer in Jesus' mind was communion. It was living in the presence and in the will and in the presence of God. It was seeking him and hearing from him and speaking to him and praising him. It was living in that very space. Now, the question we have to ask, where did Jesus come from before he did the miracle? I told you earlier. He came down a mountain, remember that? The Mount of Transfiguration. And what happened on the Mount of Transfiguration? He met with, he was in perfect communion. He heard from the Father. He was living prayer. He was living in prayer. And so as he comes down the mountain, he has power. He does not need to close his eyes and pray. He is living in prayer. And he was looking to God, and so he cast out the spirit. And so why couldn't the 9 disciples who were left, why couldn't they drive out the spirit? You know, I kind of wonder. I wonder if possibly, this is just my hypothesis, possibly, you know, the disciples who in chapter 6, we know they started to do ministry and have quite a bit of success, that when you start to become successful in ministry, it's very easy to stop looking to God, who is the one who makes successful ministry happen, and start looking at yourself, to start looking at the formulas, to start looking at the method, to start looking at what you're doing. And I wonder if, as time came along, and this is why Jesus said to the disciples, "You unbelieving generation, how long must I stay with you? Didn't you get it yet? It's not about you. It's about the Father. Didn't you get it? It's not your power or your method or your technique. It's about what God is going to do, and you need to rely on him." And suddenly, they'd started to rely on themselves, and they hit a roadblock because they could not drive out the disciple. And Jesus says, it's because of your faith, it's because of your belief, it's because of your prayer or lack of it. See, the disciples had faith, and no shortage of faith. Out of a whole crowd, including the Pharisees, the religious leaders, there was only one group of people that were willing to try to drive out the spirit. You talk about faith. They were willing to put themselves on the line. They were willing to step out and say, "We'll pray over this man. We'll pray over this boy." They had faith, but unfortunately, they had misplaced their faith. They had put their faith in faith. They had put their belief in belief. And although faith and belief can accomplish many things, faith and belief have their limits. You know, faith and belief can accomplish many things, but what we see in this is faith and belief have their limits. But with God, everything is possible. Anything is possible. You know, I referenced earlier Matthew, one of the 12 disciples who was part of the failure. He tried to cast out the demon and failed. He writes his account of what happened. And in his account, he tells the disciples, he records Jesus telling the disciples this. He doesn't mention the word prayer. But the concept is the exact same. And he says it this way. He says, Jesus replied, "The reason you couldn't drive out the spirit is this, because you have so little faith. Truly, I tell you, if you have faith as small as a mustard seed, you can say to this mountain, 'Move from here to there,' and it will move. Nothing will be impossible for you." Now, this verse, this passage kind of seems contradictory. Right? First he tells him, you couldn't do it because you have too little faith. And then he tells him, oh, by the way, all you need is little faith. So you couldn't do it because you have too little faith, but you only need faith as small as a mustard seed, which was the proverbial smallest thing. So what is Jesus saying? That your faith was so minuscule that it had to grow to the size of a small mustard seed, and that's why you couldn't do it? I think what Jesus is saying when he says you have too little faith is not the amount of faith, but actually the quality of their faith. They had misplaced their faith. And so he says, if you put your faith, even a small amount, a little faith, but if you put it in the right place, in God himself, then all things are possible. And the reason I think this is also because in Matthew chapter 19, 26, Jesus makes this statement. He says, listen, there are some things that with man are impossible. Jesus says, with man, there are some things that are impossible. It doesn't matter how much faith or how much belief you have, because belief and faith have their limits. But there are some things that are impossible with man. But what's impossible with man is what? Possible with God. And the disciples had misplaced their faith. And although faith is powerful, it had limits. And so Jesus says, listen, nothing will be impossible for you, not because of your faith, but because of the God who can do the impossible. I think the point Jesus is making, if we were to kind of summarize, what is Jesus trying to say about this whole faith and belief? I think if we were to summarize it into one small little statement that you could tweet out if you wanted or take home and remember, is this. The object and action of faith are more important than the amount you possess. the object and the action of your faith are more important than the amount that you possess. See, belief and belief and faith and faith have a lot of power, but they have limits. God is limitless. So if you're going to put your faith, even if it's only a little, put it in a limitless God. You know, the object of your faith is more important than the amount you possess. Let me give it with an example. Imagine if you put all your faith into a chair to heal your cancer. You have a lot of faith that this chair can heal your cancer, but you know, it doesn't matter how great your faith is in a chair, it will not heal your cancer. It doesn't matter how great your faith is, because faith has limits. Likewise, if you were to put all your faith in me to build you a computer or solve your software, hardware problems, I'm sorry, you can have a lot of faith in me, but I just ain't doing it. It's not happening, because you've put your faith in the wrong object, in the wrong person, in the wrong place. But I imagine if you put your faith into a sturdy, strong chair to hold you up as you sit down, and you've never seen this chair before, but you believe it can, and you show it by sitting, I bet your faith will be rewarded. And likewise, if you put your faith in me that I could teach you 2 or 3 chords on a guitar so you could play most of the songs you hear on the radio, I bet your faith will be rewarded, because you put your faith in the right place. See, the object of faith is more important than the amount you possess, but also the action of faith. Now, you may say, you know, that you really believe in a prescription medication to make you better, or a doctor, or a surgery. I believe this is going to make me better. But unless you go to that doctor, unless you take that prescription, unless you have that surgery, it doesn't matter how much you believe in it, it's not making you better. And likewise, you may be very skeptical of a certain doctor. You may be very skeptical of their prescription, and you may be very skeptical of the pills they prescribed. But with all your doubt and just a little faith, if you act on the little faith you have, you'll be better. Why? Because the object and action of faith are more important than the amount that you possess. You know, the disciples seem to have a lot of faith, enough faith to try and cast out a demon. And yet they failed because they had misplaced. They put their faith in the wrong place. On the other hand, the Father had had his faith destroyed by the failure of the disciples. He only had a little belief with a lot of unbelief. But he placed the little faith he had in a God, and he saw a mountain move in his life. He saw a miracle of God take place. Not because he had great faith. No, it was because he placed the small, you could almost say the pathetic amount of faith he had in an amazingly great God. Yeah, I wonder if some of you maybe have felt like you just need to give up on the faith. You need to give up on Christianity. You need to give up on God because you don't have faith like other people have faith. You feel like you just have so many questions and so many doubts, and you feel like, I'm just a second-class Christian. I don't even know if I'm second class. I'm not even sure if I'm one. Because I have so many questions and so many doubts and so much unbelief tied with my belief. I want to encourage you that belief and unbelief can coexist, and faith and doubt can coexist. You know, a while back I was talking to a Catholic friend I have, and he said something that was very perceptive. It got me thinking. He said, you know, and he's a guy that has a lot of questions. He probably has more doubts than faith and more unbelief than belief. And he said this, he said, you know, in the Catholic Church, there's room for people like me. They make space for people who just have a lot of doubt. But his perception of our church, and by our church, it would be evangelicalism. He says, you know, in evangelical circles, you guys are so strong on, you got to be on fire and you got to have great faith that I just wouldn't be able to exist in your environment. And it got me thinking. I think that's something that we need to change. Because Jesus had this ability to allow people who had both belief and unbelief to be in his circle. Those who had faith and doubt to be around him. In fact, he did a miracle for a man who had faith and doubt, belief and unbelief. So I want to encourage you, belief and unbelief can coexist. If you have doubt, your doubt does not have to dismantle your faith. And your doubt does not have to disqualify you from following Jesus. Here's the deal. If it was all based on our faith, If our salvation was based on our great faith, then salvation would be by works because we would have to earn it with our faith. But we know salvation is not by works, it's by God's grace. We simply take our lives and place it in his hands for him to do with us as he will, for him to save us. It's not our great faith, the smallest amount of faith, the smallest amount of saying, God, I trust you, is enough because the object and action of faith are more important than the amount you possess. Now, obviously, as you read the gospel, Jesus chastises those who have little faith, says, have more faith. And he commends those. Your faith has healed you. Obviously, the goal is for us all to grow in our faith, to take steps. In fact, our vision as a church is, or mission is to see people become devoted followers of Jesus. That means that we take steps of following him. It means that we take some faith steps. We start to grow. And so the challenge and the desire for all of us is to continue to grow in our confidence in God. You know, but great faith, if it's not exercised or acted on, is useless faith. And great faith placed in the wrong place is worthless faith. So the person that you trust and the action of your faith are more important than whether you have a lot or a little. You know, one thing I want to kind of close with is sometimes I think in Christianity, and I don't know about other faiths, but I see it in our faith, is that, you know, sometimes we start to view God a little bit like a genie, right? God is this genie, and we treat faith and prayer like it's the key to get him out. And if we just have faith and we pray, then God will come out of his little bottle and he will do exactly what we ask for every single time. And if he doesn't come out and give us what we ask for, then it's because we didn't have enough faith and we didn't pray enough. It's almost like we treat God like he's a genie in a bottle and faith is the key to get him out. But I want to tell you today, God is not a genie and faith is not the magic key to get him out. See, the problem with seeing God as a genie and faith and prayer as this key to get him out is you actually start building a God in your own image. You start building this God in your own image that says, God, if you're God, you have to answer my prayer the way I said it. And if I have faith, then you have to do what I have asked you to do. And here's what happens. When God does not answer your prayer the way you wanted, when God does not answer your prayer of faith the way you expected him because he said no, or he said wait, or he said maybe not yet, then because you have built God in your own image, you will walk away from God and say, what's the point of trusting God? I prayed in faith and he didn't answer me. And for some of you, maybe that's been your challenge. You had a mother or a grandmother who prayed, and she's the most faithful person you know. And she prayed to her God, and she prayed for healing, and God did not heal her. He did not take the cancer away. Your mother still died, whatever it is. And then you said, God, what's the point in trusting you? Because this person of faith prayed, and you didn't do anything about it. But here's what you've done. You've created a God who's a genie in a bottle who must come out by our prayer and our faith and do what we've asked. And if you feel like walking away from that God, I would tell you, do. Walk away from that God. Walk away from him because he is not actually God. He's a God of your own image, of your own imagination. I'd say get rid of that God. In fact, why not embrace a new God, the real God, a God who's actually God? But here's what's going to be the challenge. You will have to accept him as he is, not as how you wish he was. And that takes faith. That takes trust. And here's the deal. With the Father, we saw this. Belief like that is hard. Faith like that does not come easy. It's a challenge because God doesn't always answer our prayers the way we want. And here's the thing about faith and belief. It can be hard. And the Father in the story, he struggled. He had this unbelief tied to his belief. And maybe you have the question, why doesn't God just make it easier for us? Why doesn't he take away all the questions and show himself? Why doesn't he answer our prayers exactly how we wanted so we could say, there he is? I think belief, and the reason God doesn't, is because belief when it's hard proves itself genuine. Belief when it's hard actually proves itself genuine. See, here's the thing. Everyone believes when it's easy. Everyone believes when it's easy. But when the rubber meets the road, when there's unanswered prayer, when it's difficult and God says, I'm going to do it a different way than how you want, that's suddenly when it's hard and it proves whether your faith is genuine or it's not. Now, this is showed by the man in the story, but I think it's showed by Jesus himself. You know, Jesus, just hours before his death and suffering, just maybe an hour before his betrayal by one of his own disciples, he prayed in the Garden of Gethsemane, and he prayed a prayer. And in this prayer, we see Jesus' faith, his belief, and his struggle to believe. We see his belief and his ability to say, Jesus, our God, my Father, I'm going to accept you as you are. And here's what Jesus prays. He says, Father, everything is possible for you. We already saw that earlier, right? With God, all things are possible. He knew. He had full faith. God could do anything. So he prays a prayer from his perspective. He says, take this cup from me. Don't make me go through the suffering. Don't make me go through the crucifixion. God, I know everything's possible. There is another way. Take it from me. But then he ends his prayer by saying, I'll trust you rather than me. Not what I will, but what you will. See, if God had, or if Jesus had made God his Father in his own image, if he had seen God as a genie, he would have said, God, I know everything's possible for you, and I have great faith. In fact, Jesus, we could say he had the greatest faith. He is our example of what it means to walk by faith. He would have said, God, I know it's possible, so take it from me. And if your answer is no, I'm walking from you, because he would have created God in his own image. But instead, he said, listen, God, I know, and you know, I don't want to go through this. But not my will. I will trust you. And when Jesus was on the cross, he showed his faith never wavered in God, even when God didn't answer his prayer the way he wanted. And as he hung on the cross, some of his last words were this, my God, why have you forsaken me? He did not say, God, you used to be my Father, I'm forsaking you. He said, no, I still trust you. You're my God. And his faith never wavered. You know, true faith will be hard. Trials and difficulties are going to come. You know, Peter, who we think, you know, Mark got his information from Peter, and Peter's little letter that he writes, he says this about faith, kind of tying up how this whole faith thing works. And he says this, these have come, and he's talking about griefs and trials and persecutions and difficulties. These have come so that your faith, now listen, your faith, which is of greater worth than gold, even which perishes, gold perishes, even though refined by fire, these trials have come so that your faith may be proved genuine and may result in praise, glory, and honor when Jesus Christ is revealed. So maybe the question we need to ask ourselves is this, how's your faith? Not the quantity, but how's the quality of your faith? Have you placed your faith in the right person? And are you acting on that faith? You know, we all are going to have some wrestling of faith and doubt, of belief and unbelief. Are you acting on your unbelief or on your belief? Are you putting your faith in the right person? If you have small faith or faith comes really hard for you, I want to encourage you. I hope the story encourages you. That God is more concerned about the object and action of your faith than he's concerned about the amount of your faith. And I would encourage you, you're not a second-class follower of Jesus. Yes, I think your prayer, maybe your life prayer will always be what the Father's prayer was. Jesus, help my unbelief. I always have this unbelief thing, but help my unbelief. Help me act on my belief, even if it's just so small. And if you are a person who, you know, faith comes so easy to you, you're a great person of faith. You're always walking by faith, and you just have so much faith in what God can do. You believe the impossible. You've seen miracles, and God does miracles through you. I want to say, amazing. You are an example for us to follow. You're an example for your brothers and sisters, but I want to also warn you and challenge you. Sometimes when faith comes easy to us, we easily look down on those for whom faith comes more difficult. And you can start to become prideful in your faith, and you can start to think that maybe you're a little bit further ahead in the following Jesus line than everyone else, that you're first class and they're second class. And I want to encourage you, don't let pride settle in, because God is less concerned about the amount than about the quality, about the object and action. Jesus said, you only need faith as small as a mustard seed. If great faith was what he valued, he would say, you need to have mountain-sized faith. None of you can achieve that. but he didn't. He said, I'm a powerful God. Trust me.